ब्रज महोत्सव के प्रांगण में पधारे हुए जितने हमारे अतिथिगण और विद्वान हैं, जो एग्जीबिशन में या अन्य दूसरे स्थानों पर हैं, उनसे प्रार्थना है कि सभा भवन में जहाँ पर व्याख्यान होते हैं वो कृपया पधारें। डॉक्टर प्रोफेसर इरफान हबीब साहब हमारे बीच तशरीफ़ ला चुके हैं और उनका व्याख्यान कुछ ही मिनटों में प्रारंभ होने जा रहा है, अतः आप व्याख्यान कक्ष के भीतर तशरीफ़ लाने की कृपा करें। नमस्कार, राधे राधे। ब्रज महोत्सव की आज कि इस व्याख्यान धारा में सभी विद्वज्जनों का, रसिक जनों का हम हार्दिक स्वागत करते हैं। टुडे एज एवरी इवेंट इन दिस फेस्टिवल इज़ यूनिक, द फेस्टिवल इट्सेल्फ इज़ यूनिक एंड द मोमेंट्स विच मेक दिस फेस्टिवल यूनिक, दिस मोमेंट इज यूनिक ऑफ ऑल द यूनिक। वी हैव विद हस Dr. Irfan Habib, and that is it. Nothing more I can add to that. But just to recount, and some of my memories are forcing me to say something. I should have stopped there. But I cannot, because this Braj Mahotsav, which is one of the center points of Vraj Prakalpa, which was initiated by IGNCA, conceived by Dr. Kapilabhat Sen, and is going strong even at the age of 21, 22. One scholar in London used to roam in the streets of Vrindavan, going from temple to temple, and I was his bag carrier as his younger brother, Dr. Tarapad Mukhopadhyay. We collected from different temples and Goswamis the documents. But our search was not very productive. So we were very frustrated that how do we get the documents out of these religious institutions of Vrindavan? This is, I'm talking of mid-70s. We were completely frustrated. Then one of his friend, now it is history, Justice A.C. Mukherjee at Supreme Court, he said, are these Goswamis very just and peace-loving people? Tarapad said, no. They love to fight with each other. Then he said, rest assured, you will hit a gold mine. And he just ordered the district judge of Mathura, and what we found is only Dr. Irfan Habib can tell what we found there. But the miseries were multiplied. Sitting in London, Tarapad's home, Tapan Rai Chaudhary, deliberating on those documents, I am trying to struggle with some things. The documents in Sanskrit, in Rajasthani, in Persian. So Persian things were really out of our reach. So Tapanji said, you are going back to India, take this packet and meet one person who will be at this address in Firozshah Road. So I went there. The gentleman graciously called me in. He was in a meeting with somebody. He called me in. And after very brief exchanges of greetings, I said, Dr. Tapan Rai Chaudhary has asked me to see you. He said, yes. What is the matter? So I took a box of those photographs of the documents and I offered him that these are some temple documents. please have a look at it. And I left the room. Next day, almost 20 hours or more later, I get a phone call. Says, Mr. Goswami, you left the box. And since then, I've left my sleep. I've left my sleep. This is amazing. What is amazing and what was amazing, today we are so lucky. I'm not going to repeat the whole history, but we are so lucky today that history, which is made by people, history then read by people, and history then written by people. And here amongst us, we have one person who has committed to the truth of history, for whom religion sort of begins and ends with history, so truthfully. And here is an example that how the writing of history can also create history, and correct history, and correct misgivings about history. And what is that wonderful thing? For that, I invite Dr. Irfan Habib to share with us his insights into that gold mine which he hit, Dr. Irfan Habib. But before that, I will request, in the tradition of the Braj Mahotsav, to honor him, and we have our chairman, Sri Chinmay Gare Khanji, to please offer him the Uttariya and the Mahotsav brochure.
Mr. Chairman, Shri Vasji, friends, ladies and gentlemen, after the very kind words that Shri Vasji has had for me and my work on the Persian documents of Vrindavan, I find it very difficult to fulfill his expectations. Not because of any fault in the documents, but because of my inability, perhaps, to bring out the valuable and the unique and the untypical in these documents. Anyway, I would try to do so. I should begin by saying that these hundreds of Persian documents, which it has been my privilege to transcribe and study, and with Dr. Tarapada Mukherjee, we also published three essays jointly with him, and one long essay in analysis of these documents. But there is still much more that is to be found in these. But the full value of these documents, or at least a much better understanding of these documents, also comes when we consider both the other Persian material and the Braj material. As far as the other Persian material is concerned, there is the immensely rich statistical work, Abul Fazl's Ayn-e-Akbari, which provides all kinds of revenue, fiscal, price, and caste information about the localities not only of the Braj country, but also of the provinces of the Mughal Empire. It's a huge volume of statistical information. But of course, we are concerned with this information on the Braj country. Then there are letters, collections relating to Mathura and other places within the Braj region in Persian, and historical narratives which tell us about a large number of events that took place in the area. All this is in Persian, but then there is again a large amount of Braj literature, and there is the large amount of literature in Braj and Sanskrit, which of course I cannot handle and must use secondary sources for. Now, on the basis of this material, I wish to offer here a very elementary view of the life and conditions of the people of the Braj country in the 16th and 17th and early 18th century. In other words, it is a kind of look, a kind of glance at the society, economy and culture of the Braj country in the Mughal times. Now, a word about Braj Bhumi or Braj Bhum, as it's called in Braj. It is not necessarily the region in which Braj Bhasha was spoken and written. Part of the reason is that in the 17th century, the two were unconnected. Braj Bhum was related more to the holy sites related to the Krishna story around Mathura. Whereas Braj Bhasha, as far as I can understand it, experts would be able to shed light on it better. The particular term Braj Bhasha is of relatively recent origin. In fact, in the 17th century, Banarsi Das uses the word Bhasha or Desh Bhasha for it. And Mirza Khan or Mirza Jan, in fact, also uses the word Bhasha for it. He doesn't use the word Braj Bhasha. So the language doesn't designate what in the Mughal period was called Braj Bhum. Rather, it is the holy sites around Mathura to which pilgrims came and which regarded them by them as holy. Now, this is, of course, this means that Braj Bhum was much smaller than the region where the Braj dialect was spoken. This region was about at the maximum extent 100 kilometers on both sides of the Yamuna, up and down with Mathura as center. And in fact, in a parwana of 1704 by Mukhtar Khan, the Mughal governor of Agra province, within which Braj Bhum lay, mentions, gives a list of parganas which belong to Braj Bhum, which makes it clear that in his view, it stretched from Faridabad near Delhi to Ol, a little to the north-west of Agra, and from Pahari, north-northwest of Kama, to Anoop Nagar, as it was then called and it's now called Anoop Shahar, across the Doab on the Ganga River. So parts of Doab and a large part of country west of Jamna, but with Mathura as the center, was what to the Mughal administration regarded as Braj Bhum. In fact, in a Braj document of late 17th century, the term Viraj Vasi is used specifically for the inhabitants of Vrindavan. They say proudly that we are Viraj Vasis, or of course they didn't say it, perhaps the writer of the document said it, but obviously in the view of the document, it was the people of Vrindavan who were the real Viraj Vasis, or Braj Vasis. So clearly Braj Bhum was a designation of varying import. But I would concentrate on the limited area of the where the Braj speech is prevalent, which was defined by Mukhtar Khan's Parwana, and that includes practically every holy place connected directly with the Krishna legend. Now, if we look at this country, then if this area, then Agra to the south is just outside of it, and Delhi to the north is just outside of it. On the east, it stretches up to the Ganges at one point. In this area, for this area, we have very detailed information. Ayn-e-Akbari's land statistics or area statistics show that there was hardly any forest left in this area. If there was any forest, it was just along the river Jamna. Pelsart, who was a Dutch factor and who wrote in detail about the country around Agra and to its north, in his Remonstrancy dated in 1626, comments that there are absolutely no trees, or very few trees except near villages in this area, and there is extreme scarcity of firewood, so that cow dung is burnt. Cultivation was so extensive, and this was a position different from other parts of the Mughal Empire, where in fact cultivated area was much less and there was much forest. But here, not only was cultivation extensive, but the crops cultivated were also very large. Abul Fazl lists 16 crops in the Rabi harvest and 25 in the Kharif harvest, which were rated for tax in this area. Indigo or neel was a major crop, which was cultivated on the fringe of Brajbhum, Bayana on one side, and Khurja and Kol means Aligarh on the other. So, trade and commerce were penetrating agriculture, and most of the revenue here was paid by land measurement and fixed on the basis of crop cultivated, and the tax payment was in cash. That is to say, the zabt system, the cash payment prevailed. So, we are talking of an area of agriculture which was very close to the great markets of the towns of Agra and Delhi, and where money payments were common. So it was by no means a primitive region under any criteria that we could have. Now within this region, if you look at the peasants, then Vrindavan documents are of exceptional importance. These documents enable us both those in Persian and in Braj, to penetrate into the character of the village community at that time. In the villages, there were at the bottom the menial castes. And first of all, let's remember that menial castes, so-called, the outcasts, were very badly treated. According to an official census of 1641, at Wazirpur, just on the fringe of Brajbhum, in four villages, Chamars constituted, who are now known as Jatavs, 9.2% of the population. If you take note of 23 households that are assigned to them out of 249 houses in these four villages. These people were assigned small areas of land to cultivate in return for the services that they were compelled to render to the village. In a Persian document of Vrindavan of 1692, these fields are called Kisht-e-Chamaran. In other words, whereas any the fields on the boundary of this particular land, other fields, are listed under the name of the peasant, whatever his name, as far as Chamars are concerned, they do not deserve the mention of their names. It's just the field of chamars, a small field assigned to them so that they could at least subsist. Now they of course don't belong to the village community. They are not among the panch or according or in Persian muqaddams, the headmen. The headmen belong mainly to the main peasant caste in each village. For instance, in Vrindavan, which arose on the site of a village called Dosaij, the peasants were Gauravas. They are technically a Rajput caste, but placed at low status in traditional society because they ploughed, they put their hand to the plough, they had widowry marriage, and presumably they did not cremate but buried their dead. Now, they controlled all the village bodies of villages, the leaders of the village community that sold village land, waste land to the Gosains of Vrindavan, the Goswamis of Vrindavan, invariably belonged to the Gaurava community in Vrindavan. It's interesting that here caste overruled religion. A Gaurava who converted to Islam remained still head of his name was Ali Khan, son of Angad, son of Raghu Gaurava. And you can see here that he was a convert, but he continued to remain among the Panch, and he continued to be among those who sold the village wasteland to the Gosains. So again, this is quite an important indication that in ordinary peasant life, caste was far more important for one's status than one's religion. Another man, Bari Khan, appears at the head of Panch or Muqaddams, some 12 of them, in Arith, the village that was later on designated Radhakund. In 1640-42, he heads these headmen, although there was no Muslim 40 years earlier when the original land was sold. So again here you see that conversion does not undermines one's position in the village. And that's a very interesting indication of the kind of religious coexistence that prevailed at that time. In fact, there was another person called Ali Khan who intervened at a very early stage in Jeev Gosain's acquisition of land in Vrindavan by surrendering his own claims to that land in favor of Jeev Goswami. I'll come to this person presently later. Above these peasants were what Mughal documents began to call, particularly in the 17th century, zamindars. That is to say, superior landholders, superior land controllers. They might be intermediaries, they might hold large lands themselves, employing wage labor. These people obtained increasing recognition from the Mughal administration as they were obliged to collect taxes, increasingly to collect taxes on behalf of the government. And these taxes were heavy, very heavy, as I would have again, I hope, some time to point out later. No, it's all right. Yes. So long as I talk. In the beginning, these were not called zamindars. For instance, this worthy Ali Khan is called Chaudhary and Thakur. of the village Sai in the Braj version of a document of 1558, in which the Persian version calls him Muqaddam or Headman. But by the end of Akbar's reign, this class and its status was regularized in a kind of way. They used to be paid commission on what they collected, and that was called Nankar. And there was, if they were removed from this position, then they obtained what was called Malikana as compensation. Now this class was therefore important, because they had armed force. Abul Fazl says, gives a list in each Pargana of how many horsemen and how many foot retainers the zamindars of those Parganas had. So they had armed power. Now the most interesting thing in Abul Fazl's detailed list of zamindar castes of each Pargana is that Brajbhum is easily divisible into two parts. In one part, comprising wholly the eastern part, that is to say across the Jamna in Sarkar Kol, and the southern part in central Sarkar Agra, the zamindars belong to the aristocratic elements, that is to say they are thakurs or rajputs of various clans, they are Brahmans, or they are Sayyids and Sheikhzadas. In large majority, they are Rajputs. It's the general feature of Zamindar class at that time that they were in large majority Rajputs, then Brahmins, then Muslims. But in the northwestern part, and that was to be of singular importance later on in Braj history, the composition of the Zamindar class is plebeian. The Rajputs are replaced here, particularly in Sarkar Sahar, by Jats, which rather curiously the Ayn-e-Akbari, for whom rather curiously the Ayn-e-Akbari has the Punjabi spelling Jat, but they are the same. Jats, Mios, and Ahir. These are the three castes to which these Zamindars belong. Now this would be of great importance when the Jat rebellion broke out, because the leaders of the Jat rebellion were in fact zamindars from precisely this area. When the Jat uprising took place in late 17th century and early 18th century, particularly under Suraj Mal Jat, then Jat zamindari extended into the Doab, where previously in Akbar's time they only held a part of zamindari in the Pargana of Noh on the Jamna River. But then in what is now Aligarh district, Bulandshahr district, they began to have large zamindaris. In other words, the Jat rebellion resulted in a large extension of Jat zamindari, or plebeian zamindaris, let us say, at the expense of Rajput zamindars. And that resulted in a severe conflict between Rajput zamindars and Jat leaders in the 18th century in that area. In other words, the agrarian situation was not stable, and particularly towards the end, it was the unrest and instability in Brajbhum is also reflected in our documents. In these documents, the Goswamis use generally hostile words for the Jats. This may be because this was how the official Mughal administration was referring to the Jats. Even for Suraj Mal, when Suraj Mal was now a Mughal official at Mathura, the terms are of a hostile nature. The term used are of a hostile nature. But that's interesting. But for the moment, not much can be made on that. Here I would like to make the point that life was very stern for most people of Brajbhumi. There was the pressure of land revenue, which according to the Mughal historians, Persian historians, led to the Jat rebellion. On that, I would not like to say very much, except that the tax rates of the Ayin-e Akbari themselves would show you how heavy, if you relate them to the prices of food grains given in the Ayin-e Akbari itself, how heavy the taxes were, between 1/3 and half of the value of the produce. Then there were natural disasters, famines. There was a very heavy famine in 1554-56 in Brajbhumi, recorded by historians like Abul Fazl and Badayuni. And then there was the famine of 1614-16, and so on. Famines could visit any time and carry away a large number of persons. But then there were the epidemics. I studied the descriptions of witnesses in Qazi documents, in the Brindavan documents, because they all relate to Mathura. Whenever you appear before a Qazi, the Qazi noted down the description, even of women, and probably with much interest he must have noted down. But they are there. Now, I found that 40% of persons whose descriptions appear on the Qazi documents in the 17th century, 40% of them are described as bearing evidence of smallpox. That is how pockmarked faces. So 40% of them in their childhood apparently must have had smallpox, and how many died of that disease, one of course doesn't know. Then there was plague in 1615-16, which carried off probably millions of people. Of course, in Braj, hundreds of thousands probably, Brajbhumi. The high rate of infant mortality, you might note, get an impression from the evidence of Banarsi Das, you know, the famous author of Arth Kathanak in the Braj, important name in the Braj, in Braj literature. He married thrice because his two first wives died. And from all of the three wives, he had two daughters and eight sons. And all of them died. It's 100% infant mortality. He had two brothers, they also died. His two sisters alone survived till adulthood. So a middle class family, a merchant's family of Agra, this is the situation. So you can well understand how general infant mortality was and how prevalent infant mortality was at the time. And according to several estimates, the annual increase of population was about 0.2%, and probably this is due to the very high death rate of the time, which the high birth rate could not, as you can see, the birth rate was quite high from the example of Banarsi Das's family, which it could not meet with. They could, as Pelsart says, there was little to eat for working people in the cities, and that must have gone for the villagers also. Even in 19th century, ordinary peasants never ate wheat in this area. There's a very interesting survey in 1888-89 of how the lower classes lived in the northwestern provinces or UP, and the western UP evidence is particularly interesting. Nobody ate wheat among peasants. They said, one peasant said in Brajbhumi area, that our devtas also never eat wheat. What of us? So this was also prevalent there. Pelsart says they eat a little khichdi of rice with mote or green pearls with a little ghee in it. Only in the evening one meal. In the day they are able to munch a little of parched pulse or grain. So this was heavy life for the people. With how far environment and was to blame for it, and how went social organization is another issue, but the main thing remains that life was hard. Now it is in the midst of these conditions that towns arose. People did things. They built temples, for example. And I therefore want to take up the story of Vrindavan, whose citizens could proudly say that we are the real Virajvasis or Brajvasis. Now it was apparently identified by Sri Chaitanya, who died in 1533. But according to the tradition recorded in Persian documents as well as the tradition carried in Braj, it was the forest here, whatever the forest was near the Jamna. It's curiously in the book Dialogue in Stone, Vrindavan is shown on the wrong side of the Jamna, that is on the east of the Jamna. How this mistake occurred consistently in the maps in this volume is a mystery. Because I'm sure everyone in that book, concerned with that book, must have gone to Vrindavan from Mathura without crossing the river. But such is. So we know that it is in the near the Jamna, and Jamna had forests, it had ravines. Sometimes tigers lurked there. So it is quite possible that there was a small forest which Roop and Sanatan Gosain, according to these documents, cleared. Now by 1598, precisely by 5 August 1598, when a Farman of Akbar was issued, a remarkable Farman based on recommendations of a committee of three. Now, whenever you want to do anything today in the government, you appoint a committee and you do the reverse of what the committee tells you. So this was the case here. This committee recommended that a large grant should be given to these temples, but Akbar said no more than 1,000 bighas. 500 existing grant, add 500, no more. And this is all reported in the zimn, or the back of the paper, of the farman, which was usual for Mughal documents. The proposal and the order were both recorded in the back. This committee consisted of two pandits and Abul Fazl. Now, this contains a very interesting list of Vaishnavite temples of all sects in Brajbhum. There were, in the Mathura Pargana, 24 temples. Dosaij, or the future Vrindavan, was within Mathura Pargana. Out of these 24, 17 were in Dosaij or Vrindavan. Only 7 in Mathura proper. Out of 11 Pargana in Pargana Sahar, 8 were in Sahar. So there was a concentration of temples in Vrindavan. And there are the names of these temples which are given: Madan Mohal, Gobind Rai, Gopinath, Radha Vallabh, Nan Nandan, Jugal Kishore, and so forth. 17 of them. Only one I was not able to read. And grants were given individually to each temple. Now, I was just discussing it with Shivasji, and I pointed out that in fact Govind Dev is mentioned by Akbar in his early farmans in 1560s, and therefore there must have been a building, earlier building, which subsequently the Kachwaha rulers rebuilt into the present Govind Dev temple. And these grants were continued and added to by this farman. So this farman is really singular And one of the copies of these is in the National Archives. But other copies are in the old Vrindavan collection, which Sri Vatsji and Professor Dr. Tarapada Mukherjee collected. Now, as the township expanded with these temples, mainly of the Sri Chaitanya sect, the population rose, but we don't know. We know that gradually the village of Dosaich begins to be called the Kasba or township of Vrindavan. And when it comes to Aurangzeb's time, this is important enough to be given a Persian name also, and it becomes Mominabad Urf Vrindavan. And then Mominabad drops after Aurangzeb and you return to Vrindavan. Or rather, in Persian, Bindraban, which must have been the Braj pronunciation. Now, one can see the increase of pressure on the land very much as you can see in land prices in Delhi today. In 1594, you know, I traced these, cultivated land is going for 2.75 rupees per bigha. In 1611, it has risen to 12.35 paisa per bigha. I am not reading the whole list. By 1702, the price has gone to rupees 20.36 paisa. I mean, I have used decimals by converting the annas into it. Now you can see that if you really wanted to speculate, then Vrindavan was the place. You hold on to the land and not send it to Jeev Gosain or his successors. But most peasants probably didn't speculate, and gradually they sold. But as you can see, the land prices soared. And this is probably an illustration of how the kasba or township expanded. Now, the expansion of the township attracted the attention of the Mughal authorities. All of them continued the land grants which Akbar had given. Jahangir, Shah Jahan, Aurangzeb, they didn't touch the grants. Jahangir added to them. A grant of Todarmal was made into an imperial grant so that it could not be touched. And this is a singular factor, the continuous interest of Mughal administration in supporting the temples of Vrindavan. That's another story that has already been told in our essays by Tarapad Mukherjee. I wouldn't like to repeat them. They went out of their way, for instance, Shah Jahan, in allowing bells to be rung in these temples. Now, what attracted the Mughal administration was the fact that Vrindavan attracted Gauriyas and Bengalis, and that pilgrims came from all over the place to visit Brajbhumi. And they were all for encouraging, therefore, these sects, particularly the Sri Chaitanya sect, of course, which had made Vrindavan what it was. And therefore, in 1704, and remember, this is Aurangzeb's reign, 1704. Mukhtar Khan, the governor of Agra province, a very high position to which Brajbhumi belonged, issued a parwana. You see, an order which was issued by the king was known as farman. An order issued by an officer was known as parwana. Now, this parwana says that because the Gosains of the Sri Chaitanya sect, the names are given, they cleared the forest, they laid out the township, they receive a large number of pilgrims, and because of them, large numbers of pilgrims visit Brajbhumi. They don't say that is how we exploit the Bengalis, but probably that is what they intended to mean, that large people come from outside, and they usually were coming from Bengal and visit these places. Therefore, they should be supported. And as with Mughal administration, you don't support yourself, you compel others to support whom you wish to get supported. And so they imposed a levy of 1 rupee each on all villages of Brajbhum, Parya, to be paid to the leaders of the Sri Chaitanya sect at Vrindavan, to be distributed among indigent people by them in a lordly fashion, saying both Hindus and Muslims, they should receive, the indigent people, they should receive from the leaders of the Chaitanya sect. Now you can well imagine that when this amount of money flowed into hands who were allowed freedom to distribute, then there would really be some heart burning. And that heart burning came along in 1718. And there's an import, there's an interesting, I mean that you would expect in today also. The governor in 1718, Mahyar Khan of the province of Agra, now issued an order that this money is not intended only for those faqirs or mendicants of the Gaudiya sect, but also for Radha Ballabhis, Hari Sannyasis, a peculiar term which I can't identify at the moment. Perhaps there may be a mistake in my reading of the Persian word. Ramanandis, which is also peculiar because Ramanandis were not Krishna devotees. Two of whose leaders, of these three sects, two leaders each are mentioned. And it said that distribution of all this money should be done by the leaders of the, implicitly by the leaders of the Sri Chaitanya sect in consultation with them. And that what in today's language would be called transparency should be maintained. We would call it transparency. They didn't come across this word, but they said fairness should be maintained. Anyway, it means that at Vrindavan, there were now other sects also. And in fact, there is an incident, which I forgot to note here in my notes, but I should have, where there was an incident where between the Radha Ballabhis and the followers of Sri Chaitanya, there was a small riot. No one was killed in that riot, only blows were exchanged. They were quite civilized in these matters at that time. But from the Sri Chaitanya sect side, a police report was certainly made this has happened. And this is very unprecedented, and what would happen to the world if this continues, kind of thing. This brings me to the administration. What is the relationship of the administration with the people of Vrindavan? Because it is on Vrindavan that most of these documents are concerned. As Sri Vasji said, men of God are very bad men of the world. They quarrel among themselves. In the Chaitanya sect, there were quarrels about who would succeed whom. And since each religious position had property attached to it, both sides immediately went to two people, the Qazi and the Shikdar, the revenue officer. And then upwards, governor and the court, the Mughal court. They would say, for instance, that how can Krishan Priya determine the successor to her husband, because a woman is not allowed to do any such thing in the Sri Chaitanya sect. If you are looking for equality between men and women, you needn't go into the history of Vrindavan. They denied that women could have any religious position in this matter. They went to the Mughal authorities. And the Mughal authorities, like modern courts and high courts, dithered over the issue of Krishan Priya for years without deciding, until both parties died and the matter ended. There was another supporter of Krishan Priya, who was known as Kunjdas, who was her secretary, an accountant, a Kayasth. he now began to claim that I am a religious leader, I am a preceptor of Sri Chaitanya sect, and this annoyed and scandalized the whole community, because they said how a caste could pretend to lead the community or any section of the community. And there's a lot of there are many complaints against Kunj Das. I wouldn't say poor Kunj Das, because he also defied his the complainants. But all these things went before the Mughal administration. Some went through the court of Amer, later on Jaipur, the Kachwaha court, to the Mughal court. Some went direct. It was never clear whether, for instance, any complaint by a priest of Govindev would go through the Kachwaha court or could go directly to the Mughal court. It went both ways. But of course, it was the decision of the Mughal court which was final. Now here, what is interesting is the Qazi's attitude. They are generally, and it's astonishing, unless some bribe was paid, of which of course the record will not tell us, they are very sympathetic to the priests of the Sri Chaitanya sect. Almost every decision is in their favor. I will give you one example. Owing to the Jat rebellion, Shivaram Gosain left Vrindavan, and then after some time he returned in 1675. He found that while his other tenants gave him rent, one particular chap called Arjun refused to pay him anything and said that this house has now become mine because you disappeared. So he went to the Qazi, and the Qazi at Mathura then went all the way to to Vrindavan the same day, and he immediately consulted the neighbors of Arjun, including a woman, Ganga Dasi, daughter of Krishan Das. A curious decision. And since this woman and others said that yes, Arjun was his tenant and is not paying the rent, the decision was then and there taken in favor of the Goswami, and the tenant was turned out. This is recorded in the Qazi's judgment. So Qazi's judgments are already in favor. But remember, a Persian phase, Qazi Barishwat Razi, that is, if you want to have the Qazi on the outside, give him a bribe. So these documents don't tell us. So don't take it as a practice of immense tolerance by the most orthodox of Mughal jurists. It's not, it may not be. But, you know, it means that there is a functioning judicial administration, not very different from the present judiciary. I wouldn't like to commit contempt of court, but you can understand. There are sometimes... remarks and observations of Mughal officials which are due to compassion. One is in connection made by a well-known Mughal official, Izzat Bakhsh Rasa, a poet belonging to Nur Jahan's family, so probably in a position where bribery was not very important in his life. He was Diwan-e-Bayutat, the treasury official of the Agra province. He learnt from a complaint by Gobind Charan Goswami that the Goswami's house and two shops in Mathura had been seized by the Baitul Mal or Imperial Treasury officials because he had left the place. He had been complaining again and again under two predecessors of Izzat Bakhsh Rasa, but the officials did not release the buildings to him. So Izzat Bakhsh Rasa then, in his order of 2 February 1706, makes a short observation in his own writing. Do obey the above order. Please behave with ordinary people that their interests don't come to harm. Well, of course, the Gosain was not an ordinary person, but this appeal is particularly compassionate. And we know, since Izzat Bakhsh Rasa is otherwise known to him, known to us. This is a peculiar, this particular aspect that we didn't know about before. I will end by saying that Braj language, Braj culture became of particular interest to the Mughal literary elite and officials when the capital shifted to Agra. Agra was actually on the fringe of the Braj country, Braj Bhum. And certainly the dialect of the country around Agra was Braj, as we call it today. There was therefore written a very interesting work, which I believe has been translated into Hindi, Tuhfatul Hind by Mirza Jahan, late in Aurangzeb's reign, beginning with the praise of this emperor, deals with music and with performing arts, the theory of music and dance, and then with the Braj language, its rules of grammar and its glossary. I don't know if this is the first earliest glossary of Braj language as such, which we have got, which always it's called Bhaka, or the hard SH, Bhasha, which in Persian was always called Bhaka. For instance, Upanishad were always called Upanishad. So this was the ordinary pronunciation of the time. So Baze Qawaid Kulya Bhaka, with a glossary, with a dictionary. There are earlier dictionaries also of dialects going back to 1469, a dictionary compiled at Bhopal, but for the Braj, I think this is the first or the earliest Braj Persian dictionary. All in all, therefore, one knows from our documents a lot about Braj Bhum, its people, its culture. We certainly want to know more. And there are aspects which I have not covered. For instance, the religious aspect, the views of the religious sects, the temples, the architecture, and so on, which, of course, is beyond my field. I have restricted my presentation to what I know most from the sources I have dealt with. Thank you very much.
We have just been treated to a most wonderful presentation by Dr. Irfan Habib. I think all of you will agree that he transported us back 5-6 centuries, and I at least felt that, you know, that I lived through those times myself. He made his presentation so lively and so alive, become alive, that I think we've all felt that we were living in those times, and that we were plowing our fields, or we were going to the temples, or we were going to the Qazi, maybe to give him a little bit of rishwat. It was really most wonderful, a very scholarly presentation, the like of which I think is very rare to come across. From what he told us, we now know that the people in those times were not particularly conscious of ecology. They destroyed the little bit of forest that they had and built it up. Life was very tough. I would have thought that life in those days must have been, you know, much better, if simpler, but also not so hard that people didn't even have, or most people didn't have, even have 2 square meals a day. That really came as a bit surprise to me. The jurisprudence of those days, the judiciary of those days, the revenue administration, the taxation system, the infant mortality rates, All this, I think, might lead one to conclude that life in India over the last 500 years has improved. Don't you agree? Comparatively speaking, even if we have famines, nobody dies of famine these days. And if not everybody still has 2 square meals a day, but I think the percentage of people who do not have 2 square meals a day today is probably less than what it was 500 years ago. So all in all, a most wonderful afternoon we all had, thanks to Dr. Habib. And I would like you all to join me again, once again, in giving a big round of applause to him. Thank you, Sivatji, for making this possible and for bringing such a learned and empathetic scholar in our midst. And thank you all for coming in such large numbers. Thank you.
Professor Habib has agreed that if there is any intervention or comment or any reaction from the floor, it will be welcome for a few minutes. And as he has to straight away drive back to Aligarh and take that arduous journey, so we have to be brief if there is any.
While talking about the culture of Braj, perhaps you have not mentioned about the certain Muslim poets who have contributed a lot to the Braj Bhasha literature. I'll mention only one name, Ras Khan. And I don't know whether you have mentioned about it earlier or not. Ras Khan, and not only Ras Khan, but there are few others also who seem to be Krishna Bhaktas when they write about Krishna and the Lord. You told that you have covered those aspects, a particular area. Maybe it may not be your field, but still I dare, or I may be excused to ask this thing.
Well, actually, I said at the end that I have not intruded into fields which are not my own, and literature is one of them. So I, both religion and literature, I couldn't, because it's not only Muslim poets, but Surdas is there, and even Guru Arjan composed in Braj. So these things I have not dealt with. I have only dealt with the society and culture of people at large, and not specifically with literary and religious tradition.
I really thank Professor Irfan Habib for this wonderful talk. And all these 5 days, and also before that, I think we were so accustomed to a different narrative, and I think Goswamiji would have to do a lot of, you know, questions and, you know, answer us that this is the narrative of the Goswamis, and then you bring a narrative from the history which is, you know, at odds with the kind of narrative which is built in the shelter of a mysticism of the place and the historical documents, even the fact that the way we present that how Akbar gifted the land grant to, and the way that you put it, and the way that Goswamiji had put it 2 days ago. So I, taking both the narratives into account, I still wonder that amidst so much of poverty and so much of corruption, that the kind of aesthetic sensibilities that developed in that period, unless, you know, that also becomes part of a third narrative. So in a way, you know, I've left really a little confused over the various narratives that are coming here through Braj, your historical narrative, his very religious narrative, and if we go out and look at the aesthetics of the exhibition. So, you know, maybe can we find some kind of anchor that would thread these narratives, or are they going to be always separate and we approach each very differently?
I actually recognize the problem. Ideas move across people and minds in a different way than material life moves. Of course, both influence each other. And I think the late Dr. Tarabhad Mukherjee was right in writing a letter to me that please study these documents without thinking of Jeev Goswami as a great religious thinker. Religious thinkers have also to eat, they have to find money for the temples, they have to meet Bhagwan Das or Man Singh and later on their successors, Mirza Raja Jai Singh and so forth. So they have a worldly aspect, which does not necessarily diminish their contribution to the religious faith. I recognize that. But both influence each other, of course. I said in the beginning that I am taking only the worldly aspect. I have no pretensions to define how religions, how religious life operates. Perhaps because my own religious beliefs are so minimal, hardly existent. So I really can't understand how religious people proceed. But they do proceed. They strongly have beliefs and they act on them. So it's quite likely, and it has been so throughout human history, that poverty does not diminish a love of fine art. Otherwise, pyramids would not have been built. The great Taj Mahal would not have been built. So all these things are there. They do not diminish also the religious spirit. But the religious spirit is of different types, and I presented the view that in at least secular life there was a considerable amount of adjustment and accommodation in Brajbhum during Mughal times. Thank you.
I will just conclude by using my privilege of getting the permission of the chair. Sir, I can assure you that Krishna and his follower Goswamis in the land of Vrindavan is not doing bad. The Goswamis are fighting more, and the land prices are something like 50 to 70,000 rupees per square yard today. But the good news is, the good news not just for me, but for all of us, and especially for the Braj Prakalpa, that this mine of information, of these documents, Dr. Abhib has agreed to make it available in a transcription, translation, and he will add his analytical studies on this material. And I tell you, that will be the biggest gift we will receive from him. Tremendous. And we are really grateful for you, sir, for that. Just for few information, that Hari Sanyasi is the Haridasi Babajis who were living in Tatiyasthan and all. So they were known as that. And these documents, when they come, will definitely open different other avenues. The avenues, as you said, about literature. Today I saw a gentleman who has spent his whole academic life drowned in Surdas, sitting with Dr. Habib and checking on this one date and one word, because that perspective of the document and the history is going to unfold a tremendous different perspective on literature itself. So he is so true. So he is providing us the ground on which all these literary and artistic and other cultural facets of academic approaches will depend so much on that raw material. So we thank again on behalf of IGNCA and Braj Mahotsav that you could spare this time for us and be with us. And thank you again. And thank you all. We will move, have some coffee, and then we will enjoy the Charkula dance. And from there, we will move to an art form which the Mughals gave a kind of prime hue to it, the classical North Indian music. And Padma Shri Shubha Mudgal will bring to us, in that Khyal Gayaki tradition, how the temple music became an integral part, and especially in the recent past.